Hello.
Oh, hello, Ken.
Well, Alan, how are you?
I'm good. It's good to talk to you.
Well, good to hear your voice, my friend.
Yeah.
We are here to discuss your recent book, Consciousness Explained Better, Towards an Integral Understanding of the Multifaceted Nature of Consciousness. And as you know, I thought you did a terrific job in summarizing my view and your view of consciousness. And so I thought what we'd do is just go through the book, and I'm going to read a few highlighted areas, and then we can discuss them. How's that sound?
Sounds good to me.
Excellent. We start with William James used two metaphors to characterize conscious experience. The first was of a flowing stream, while the second was of the flights and perchings of a bird. In the latter metaphor, the flights represent moments of transition between one thought and another, from one idea, recollection, sensation, or feeling to another. The perchings occur when our awareness stops to rest in the presence of these ideas, recollections, sensations, or feelings. James eventually came to refer to these islets as buds, drops, or pulses of experience, each a complete experiential event in itself. The term bud is especially suggestive because it implies a living process that gives birth to further experiences. Each is the product of preceding buds, such as previous thoughts, memories, and sensory impressions, and it in turn contributes to the creation of future buds. Recognizing the importance of this idea, the 20th century American philosopher Alfred North Whitehead adopted the notion of buds or drops of experience from James, placing it in a larger metaphysical vision of the entire cosmos as experience. In his principal work, Process and Reality, he quotes James, "Our acquaintance with reality grows literally by buds or drops of perception. Intellectually and on reflection, you can divide these into components, but as immediately given, they come totally or not at all." End quote. The point here is that a bud or drop of experience cannot be teased apart into the threads of which it is composed, except by subsequent reflection. Each bud or pulse is a whole event, complete in itself. This basic idea is not limited to perception, but applies to all forms of experience. We see that James and Whitehead had much in common. Though James emphasized personal experience and Whitehead cosmology, both emphasized process, James with a stream of consciousness and Whitehead with a metaphysical vision of reality itself, including the whole manifest universe. The idea that experience, individual as well as cosmic, presents itself as buds, drops, or pulsations is important in both. It is an idea indebted to the image of the bird that flits from limb to limb and is central for both James and Whitehead. Interestingly, a similar idea is found in Buddhist phenomenology, which parses time into momentary occasions or dharmas. So that's a fundamental starting point, and the notion of buds or drops of experience is really a beautiful idea, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is. And it really emphasizes the notion, I think, or clarifies the notion that James, like Whitehead, was a process thinker.
Right.
And much of your work has this element as well.
Right.
So often people will say, well, so and so is a structuralist. Well, and there is no process. Well, I think they miss the point. This is a real fundamental idea.
Right.
It also influenced Niels Bohr, who had
Right.
read James as a young man and was very interested in this sort of duality of nature, especially these two metaphors,
Right.
the bird perching and then flying and then a stream, and came up with the duality idea of particles and waves,
Right.
which are still a very fundamental aspect of reality as far as we know.
Right. And the whole notion of structuralism has been so poorly understood. It's really a form of holism, and it refers, particularly the way I use it, as to the holistic patterns of these drops of experience. And so it's referring to the holistic nature of this moment-to-moment stream of consciousness, and that it does contain patterns. On reflection, we can discern patterns. And so that's the only thing. Structuralism is so badly misnamed, you know. It sounds just like bricks and mortar.
Well, yeah.
But it turns out that, like light, when conscious experience is passed through the appropriate prism, it too can be seen in multiple colors, or speaking literally, in multiple perspectives. This is the prism of reflective awareness by which we each can examine the facets of our own experience. In this way, we will first see how consciousness bifurcates naturally into two streams of experience, then how it further divides into four streams. Later in the book, we will find that passing through the proper prism of reflection, it can be seen to divide again into eight streams. I will not belabor this point throughout the book, but it is important to realize that our experience of ourselves and the world in which we live is a product of the ways in which we perceive them. The alternative view is what philosophers term naive realism, meaning the belief that reality is exactly what it appears to be. And that's a belief that we have long ago given up on, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly have, although it's still fairly popular out there. But
yeah.
among the common folks. But this division into the four quadrants, of course, I think all folks listening to our dialogue will be familiar with the four basic quadrants in the Atal model. But
right. This
is a very important bifurcation. This is a very important break from older traditions, because what we're doing here now is we're shifting gears and we're beginning to talk about what has been called consciousness's perspectives.
Right.
And we didn't read from the first chapter, and that's fine, but the first chapter really, I try to point out that the word consciousness itself is pretty bankrupt.
Right.
And William James, in fact, dumped it. He started to use the word experience, which was a little better, but sort of kind of hedges a bit.
Right.
But when you shift gears and when we start to talk about these four perspectives, and keep in mind that each of them is a stream, in a sense, that experience
flows
through these different dimensions or these four perspectives, we suddenly get a radically different view of what experience is all about.
Right.
And as we move through our day and our moment-to-moment experience, each instant is painted by these four perspectives.
Right.
This is what we're experiencing.
Right.
And it creates a really rich phenomenology, if you want to call it that. And then, of course, later in the book and in your own work, drawn from your own work, we can divide those further into interior and exterior aspects. So we end up with eight.
Right.
So this is a very rich process. And as we'll get to probably later in our conversation, it's my contention that over the course of history, the number of perspectives available to us as artists and as scientists and so on has expanded.
Right. Yeah, it's clearly an evolutionary event going on here. But you're right, the essential point about each drop of experience irreducibly having these four perspectives is really a radically new way to look at consciousness. And it just stops arguments about, you know, which is real, interior or exterior, which is real, singular or collective. It basically just says that all of them are equally real and none of them can be reduced to the others. And attempts have consistently failed to do so, and there's a reason. The reason is they are irreducibly aspects of each moment's experience. So let the reductionism stop here.
Well, as you know, I've been toying with a little paper that I plan to present at the JFK Integral Theory Conference.
Right.
In which I show basically that you can collect all the theories of consciousness that are out there in academia and put them in these different quadrants.
Right.
And, you know, they're almost all in one place or another.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to read the abstract from that. And it does go to show that this really is also, it's truly integral. It's truly covering the bases. These four quadrants, or more particularly eight zones, really do cover most of the perspectives that we have available. And that's what makes it so interesting. The first fractionation of experience by the prism of refraction divides it into an outer and an inner dimension, and outside and an inside. The second fractionation of experience by the realm of refraction divides it into singular and plural parts, or the perception of individual objects and processes on the one hand, and groups of objects and processes on the other. This four-quadrant approach will already be familiar to many readers. The two left-hand quadrants represent our perceptions of inter-experience, while the two right-hand quadrants represent our perceptions of the outer world. At the same time, the two upper quadrants represent our perceptions of single objects and events, while the two lower quadrants represent multiple objects or events. Each quadrant represents both a broad category of knowledge and a basic dimension of the world as we perceive it. We find I in the upper left quadrant, representing personal internal realities, and we, the pronoun we, in the lower left quadrant, representing shared internal realities. In the upper right quadrant, we find it, representing single instances of objective objects and events, and the lower right pronoun its, representing groups or collections of objects and events. So those are the four basic, and as you say, there's each of those, as you look at the events or processes in those, they can also be looked at from the inside and the outside, giving us essentially eight basic zones or eight basic perspectives. And these really do cover the bases, and that's what's so important about it, is once you realize that these perspectives are there, it just ends a whole lot of arguing, of trying to reduce one to the other or make one more real than the other and so on. And that's one of the big steps here.
It's so important to realize that these are perspectives. And I think that's often forgotten because there's a real tendency, even upon thinking one understands the four quadrants and the
right.
eight zones, if you include the interior and the exterior, it's easy to think, well, we can carve the world up that way.
Right.
And I suppose we can, but the more basic view here, and I think the real exquisite aspect of this system, philosophical system, if you like, is that these represent different ways of experiencing the world.
Right.
One of the things that I think is interesting is that as soon as Descartes got out his carving knife and cut the world into an inside and an outside, then people scrambled to decide which one was real.
Right.
And so you had idealists like Berkeley, said, well, it's all on the inside, or at least it's all mine.
Right.
And then John Locke scrambled around and tried to show that it's all on the outside.
Right.
And the interesting thing about John Locke was the only way he could really show it's all on the outside is to say, well, it's all experience. So it's really all on the inside, but everything on the inside is from the outside.
Right.
And then shortly after that, the whole tradition of quote-unquote British empiricism and empiricism in general, using the word in a kind of degraded sense it's used so much nowadays, was that what's real is what's solid in consciousness is a kind of steam that comes off of it or something.
And, right.
So anyway, I think this is a major shift in the way we're looking at things.
Right, and absolutely. And then we make a little bit of a distinction here between what we call quadrants and quadrivia, as you explain it. But one important point here, and an obvious one, is that inanimate objects such as stones, cell phones, computers, and book jackets do not have such perceptions because they are not alive and are not conscious. You can look at a physical object, say your computer, from any of the four perspectives, but the computer itself does not look back at you, at least in any conscious way. Nevertheless, we have fairly complex feelings about our personal computers. The upper left, we seem to be in some sort of human-machine relation with them. The lower left, we recognize them as a physical objects, upper right, and we may have several computers in our home that are networked together for purposes of file sharing and so on, the lower right. Thus, your computer can be the object of perceptions that arise from all four quadrants. But these are your quadrants and not those of the computer. It does not have quadrants because it is not a conscious being. If, however, we shift our point of view from the person perceiving to the object perceived, in this instance, the computer, then, we use the term quadrivia. In these instances, we are speaking of the quadrivia of the computer rather than the quadrants that refer to actual streams of experience. And so that's just a little straightforward distinction in terms of, you know, quadrants belong to living things, and quadrivia are the objects of perceptions of living things. Same essential distinction. And so one applying to the living world that are having these drops of experience, and then the other applying to the non-living world, or really other living things, as long as they're being perceived.
Right.
So to move on, to understand consciousness as lived experience, we need to look beyond abstract reflections to actual moment-to-moment reality. How all this gels together to paint for each of us a canvas of personal reality depends on a number of things, none more important than our own level of growth and maturation. Perhaps it is not news that our understanding of the world in which we live changes as we grow from infancy to childhood and on to adulthood. This change in all the gradations it entails gives our experience a palpable developmental dimension. In fact, developmental changes are seen in all four quadrants. As we grow mentally, our bodies grow too, as do the kinds of relationships we have with others. Our sense of community transforms from the first infantile union with our parents, especially our mother, to an emerging awareness of ourselves as individuals, and then on to an understanding of our place in the larger communities which we take part. These communities include our extended families, our colleagues at work, our spiritual companions, and so on. Thus, we can track the path of growth in all four quadrants, seeing that each is correlated with the others. And, you know, as important as development is, it's still shocking how rarely it's taken into account.
Oh, yes. I was just listening to your conversations with Bob Keegan.
Right.
And, of course, as you both point out, it tends to be invisible from the inside.
Right.
Which is interesting, unless you use your memory to think back about different times in your life. And one of the things I try to do in this book, as you know, is remind the reader of what it was like to be a 3 or 4 year old and to really think back about those memories and look at those memories. And, of course, what we find is when we were children, we had we were confused by a lot of things that
today
are pretty obvious. I give a number of examples there. And we live in a, you know, it depends on what age we're talking about, but for young children, a kind of imaginary world, for example. And then we get a little older, and we look for rules, and we emphasize rules a lot. We live by rules and so on. So there are several chapters there where I actually try to develop examples.
Right.
From actual people's actual memories. Actually, when I wrote the chapter on the earliest period, one of my readers came back and said, yeah, it's sort of a boring chapter. I read it, and I thought, well, he's right. And I went on the web, and I did a search for earliest memories. As you know, I came up with a couple of pages of examples of earliest memories.
Right.
There was a alligator lived under my bed.
Right, eating a worm.
I ate a worm.
Yeah,
and these are beautiful examples of experiences of very early childhood.
Right.
And
then
you get a little older, and these you get into these conundrums. I remember 3rd or 4th grade, we got in trouble for throwing snowballs at the girls.
Right.
That gave you an idea how the world's changed since then. And I remember the teacher bringing in this boy, and he walked in the door to the class. He said, I wasn't throwing snowballs. And she said, you just gave yourself away. And I was incensed. I said, gave himself away? Well, he just told you that he hadn't thrown them. you know, and all of these sorts of things. They give a number of examples in the book of sayings that are confusing to children. The stitch in time saves nine.
Right.
Well, I never could figure out how you could put a thread through time.
Right, right.
So I think one of the really important messages that I try to get across is not sophisticated developmental psychology, of which there's plenty,
right.
But there's a tendency even among those of us who are interested in development to read about stages of development and forget that we're talking about whole worlds of experience.
Exactly.
That go through transformations and then
exactly.
forget them again.
And that's what's so surprising. I mean, these stages, you know, that the mind goes through, they're so different. And like you say, they're not even really stages of looking at the world. They're actually different worlds that come into being. And that's so profound and so important. And having worldviews like the magic and the mythic and the rational and the pluralistic, these are major worldviews that we can see every day in the editorial columns with the culture wars being argued in your traditional values versus scientific values versus postmodern values, not realizing that those are essentially products of developmental stages. And yet, you know, everything else in nature we understand develops. We know that eggs grow up and go through stages and end up as chickens.
Yep.
It's not just, you know, there isn't just a chicken in running around out there. And yet we seem to think that human beings exist in this flatland where they all have the same world and the same worldview. And it's astonishing because it's just not true at all.
Robert Keegan points out, and you do too in your conversations, that we accept these things in children, and we think they're cute, and we accept them in adolescence as life, and we even accept them in young adulthood in a way. So, well, he's just young.
Right.
But then when you become an adult and somebody, you know, starts talking about your own developmental stage, suddenly it doesn't feel so comfortable, and then, as Bob points out, these ethnic issues come up.
All right.
I had a lady get up in the back of one of my lectures, who's a prominent anthropologist, as far as I know, from one of the Ivy Leagues, and she said, well, I quit reading this stuff when they quit reading anthropology. This group of islanders, I don't know which islanders they were, went 1,500 miles across the ocean with no compass and so on. Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it was one of the lost tribes that didn't have any sense of direction, or maybe there were children who were just told to go downwind. But whatever it is, one of the points I try to make in the book is that this doesn't tell you anything about their ego development.
Yeah, exactly.
And it doesn't tell you a lot about their intelligence either. I presume they were intelligent. I don't know who she was even talking about, but one of the interesting things I talk about in the book is this sort of what I call adult children, this period of concrete operations.
Right.
Sort of the Potter, what's his name? Potter.
Yeah, Harry Potter.
Harry Potter, yeah, well, of course, he's older now, but sort of Harry Potter age, or Lord of the Flies, if you want a hardcore version of it, that kids who have concrete operations, that is, they're capable of logical thinking to a degree, can be very smart. They can play chess and play checkers.
Right.
They can do all kinds of things. One of the things they can't do is debate, though, because debating requires broad concepts of ideas like justice and equality.
Right.
And those are abstract. They don't have abstract concepts.
Right. So they can do spelling bees, but they can't do debates.
That's right. And people have tried it, and they thought, well, debates would be great, and it fall flat.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the thing about anthropologists, you know, sort of denying Piaget, that's such a canard, because Piaget's system has now been tested on numerous cross-cultural societies, including Amazon rainforest Indians and including Aborigines, as well as numerous other, quote, more developed countries. And there have been no major exceptions found to his system. The one exception that the postmodernists all use is the way they word it is they'll say, well, not all cultures have been shown to develop formal operational cognition. Therefore, his system doesn't work. But what they don't point out is that that becomes, some cultures just aren't that developed. And when they do develop, they develop formal operational cognition, just like his system says. So it's you know, we can tinker with it, as you point out, but some of its essential points in phenomenology are just as real as when he developed them.
Yeah, and I think that Bob made an excellent observation in your conversation with him, and you as well, that the best way to overcome the kinds of cultural stereotypes and biases we have, black folks are lazy, for example, and these people over here are shiftless, is to develop within ourselves a high enough level of personal complexity and development that we can see through those stereotypes.
Right.
And not believe them. So.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because these are products of lower levels of development.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the point about understanding development and developmental stages is just that. It can increase your understanding and communication with other people. It's not meant as a judgment system or a nasty ranking system or anything like that at all.
No.
So speaking of this early period of childhood, we can improve our understanding of these three stages, and these are early sensory motor, preoperational, concrete operational, of development by taking advantage of the investigations of psychologists who have labored to discover how children grow. For instance, during the middle decades of the 20th century, the Swiss researcher Jean Piaget made great contributions to our understanding of the mind of the child. Though there have since been many refinements of his work, the basic model he created remains the cornerstone of developmental psychology even today. At the core of Piaget's thinking is the concept of schemas, or schemata. In its original Greek meaning, a schema is literally a shape or a plan. The idea is best translated into modern English as a pattern, in this case, of thought or behaviors. Each level of achievement, each new and more sophisticated schema, is built from the schemas below it. It's built like building a house. Each floor rests on the one below, except that in the house of mathematics, each is actually made out of the floor beneath, all the way down and all the way up. Now we come to another important point. No step can be omitted or passed over. In other words, you cannot build a house starting with the second or third floor while the space below remains empty air. Likewise, no one can leapfrog to advanced levels of growth without first mastering the earlier elementary levels. We have here a central principle of mental development, and indeed of psychological development in general. No step or stage can be omitted. Each must be experienced and absorbed completely before moving on. This goes for virtually all types of development, whether we are learning mathematics or formal logic, moral reason or jurisprudence, artistic or musical skills, and so on. One must acquire the basic concepts or schemas and from them develop more complex and supple schemas. And let's not forget that our primary interest is in the experiential worlds through which childhood carries us. The important point here is that we experience those worlds because they are patterned for us by our own inner schemas. Piaget divided childhood into four periods or stages. These are briefly introduced below because they're the starting points for understanding much of the discussion of child and adult development that will follow. With these in mind, we can see how childhood experiences of the self and world change as we grow. Later, we will explore the strange idea that the growth and development of every child mirrors the much larger developmental history of human consciousness. So that's the general point overview, and indeed, the fact that stages can't be skipped. It's like any actual stage sequence. If you have atoms, molecules, cells, organisms, you can't go from atoms to cells and skip molecules. They're actual building blocks of the subsequent stages. So skipping is not allowed.
It's hard to imagine a cell with no molecules inside of it.
Doesn't
work very well.
And of course, it's one of the things that we keep in mind for structural development is just that, is that you cannot skip these structures. And so if it appears that you're skipping, then you're probably working with something else, but you're not working with these structural stages. You might be working with some states or something like that, but not these structures.
Well, this was all hammered out in psychological research back in the 60s when Piaget basically came to the U.S. and was challenged by people like B.F. Skinner. Skinner said, well, all you have to do to train a child to add is you give them 4 and 4, and they have to make some response that symbolizes 8.
Right.
And Piaget said, well, yeah, you can teach a child to say 8 when you present them with 4 plus 4, but it doesn't mean they'll know what it means.
Right.
What to do with. And sure enough, the research showed very clearly that if you take the child to the grocery and you get a bag with 3 apples and a bag with 4 apples or 4 pears in it, and you say, how many fruits do we have here? The child won't have a clue.
Right.
Unless they have previously learned the number concepts and how to count. These are
right.
Basic. And then the basics of addition, which is sort of successive counting.
Right.
So the research has shown this to be very, very clear.
And that was one of the important things that Piaget did, is he asked the child the second and third and fourth question. So whereas somebody like Skinner might ask the child, why is that 8? And you'd say, well, and the child might say, well, 4 and 4 is 8. But Piaget would say, now, what do you mean by 4 and 4? And what does 4 mean? And what does 8 mean? And the child doesn't know that, doesn't have any real understanding, like you say, of the overall process. And so no real understanding of what's going on. And so it was Piaget, by asking those questions, that he really dug into these schemas and dug into the worldviews of the child and young adult, and was able to lay out the actual patterns that we were working with here. And this was very new. This was an extraordinary breakthrough.
Very new. When Piaget graduated from the specialized, or I should say, rather refined Catholic high school, equivalent high school, he went to, every student there was asked to make a life commitment of some kind. Something we don't do much today, but his commitment was to what he called genetic epistemology.
Yep.
And what he meant was nuts and bolts empirical epistemology. Hey, how do we know stuff?
Right.
So he was trying to figure out how we know stuff.
Exactly.
And
genetic meant in the sense of genesis or life or growth.
Yeah.
So it was developmental epistemology.
Right.
Immanuel Kant had come up with all of these, you know, these dozen or so concepts, a priori concepts of the understanding that the human mind uses, things like causality and so on. And Piaget basically said, yeah, but where do those concepts come from?
Exactly, that's exactly right.
And they can only be conceived as ones that have developed, as Hegel put it.
We weren't born with them.
That's right. And so, you know, this sort of, it seems so obvious now, but back then it wasn't. And even more amazing, he came up with a lot of this stuff just by researching his own kids.
Oh, it was mostly his own kids.
It's astonishing that he would do that. The sensory motor period is the first developmental stage and is named for the fact that children are primarily involved in acquiring basic sensory and motor skills such as crawling, standing, walking, and grasping, and coordinating these with vision, hearing, and so on. During the second half of his or her first year of life, the infant begins to differentiate from the mother or primary caretaker in a physical sense, gaining the first awareness of its own body as separate from the mother's body and surroundings. In the second year, he or she begins to acquire a separate sense of an emotional self as well. At this age, the world of the child is egocentric. That is, the child sees everything from his or her own point of view, even to the extent of being perceptually bound. The latter means that a child cannot imagine what it is like to see things from somewhere else, such as from the other side of the room, even if he or she just returned from there.
And as you know, and wrote about years ago, the failure to make this distinction results in an adult who is still what we call a narcissistic personality disorder.
Exactly. Yeah. And narcissistic doesn't mean that the person spends a lot of time thinking about themselves. It means just the opposite, that they can't think about themselves. They can't self-reflect. They can't introspect, and they don't have a sense of self. And so they will hide under a pillow and think that that you can't see them because there's no worldview but theirs. And so, you know, this is just that completely egocentric and narcissistic in that sense, and adualistic in the sense that there is no earliest stages, no separation between subject and object, and then it starts to differentiate and we get...
pre-personal.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That moves us into the pre-personal period. No. This is sometimes called the play period for obvious reasons. During this period, children begin to acquire many mental schemas so basic to understanding reality that as adults, it is difficult to imagine living without them. They include the earliest intuitions about space, time, and causality, though children do not yet entertain conscious thoughts about these. Their world is still egocentric or centered about themselves. And through most of this period, children aren't able to sort objects or ideas according to more than one aspect at a time. It is not difficult to understand that the pre-operational child is often given to magical thinking, which is another way of saying they live in a magical world. Such thinking confuses fantasy with objective reality. If you ask a four-year-old why it rains, he or she may tell you it is so that flowers can grow and blossom. Physical objects such as dolls and other toys can have lives of their own. Imaginary playmates are not uncommon during this period. Moreover, children at this stage often blame themselves for events that are not of their own doing. A three-year-old boy might tell you he hurt his knee because he was playing in the front yard where his mommy told him not to go, rather than because he tripped on a stone. Tragically, children often blame themselves for parental conflicts in which they played no part whatsoever. Another one of the important parts of development, isn't it, is that things can go wrong at the early stages and stay with us indefinitely.
That's the whole point, yeah. And we can understand that, especially if we keep in mind the different lines of development. Especially
right.
In the personality, that one aspect of a person can just get stuck.
Right.
And in other ways, they continue to develop. So you meet this person on the street and or wherever, and they seem perfectly normal until some particular thing comes along. Their ability to relate on an intimate level, for example, or their
right.
ability to reflect on them, whatever it is. And
yeah.
that one is stuck way down there.
Very true. One of the things that we're just learning more about is that there isn't a single developmental sequence, as Piaget sort of tended to assume, but that we have multiple intelligences. So there's not only a cognitive intelligence, which was Piaget's specialty, but there is a moral intelligence, there's an emotional intelligence,
no.
there's an introspective intelligence, there's an introspection intelligence, there's musical, mathematical, kinesthetic, and all of these can develop to some extent independently. And so we're just starting to learn about that and learn about the similar altitudes that
yeah.
they go through, but any one of them can get caught up in these early years and never really recover.
That's right.
So then we move into the concrete operational period, all about understanding symbols and following rules, rules of logic, rules of language, and rules of behavior. Though it may seem that during this stage the children act and think like adults, there's an important difference. The mental achievements of concrete operations are limited by the fact that they must always deal in concrete objects and events. Young people in this stage do not think in terms of abstractions.
These are the adult children I was talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The Harry Potter stage.
Yes.
see-through mechanical models, for example, are excellent for teaching science at this stage, and if the teacher does not actually have physical objects such as marbles, bananas, or mechanical models, then he or she needs to talk about concrete objects and situations. It is only later, when young persons achieve the next stage, termed formal operational, that they will be capable of abstract thought. And as you point out, that's if they achieve formal operational, and not all of them do.
It's surprising. I mean, I've seen a lot of research that people have done on entering college freshmen, you know, who are 16 to 20 years old. I would say most of them are not formal operational yet. They're still concrete operational.
Yeah, and that's so fascinating, because formal operational, you know, people tend to think of it as, when they hear that it's abstract, they tend to think of it as just that, being really abstract and dry and, you know, a mathematical professor kind of thing. But it takes formal operational thinking, for example, to understand what if and as if proposition. So what if this happened, and so on and so on, or what if I did this, and so on and so on. I mean, it's really the basis of a lot of dreaming and idealistic wishes and hopes and, you know, changing the world through visions. And so it's not just a dry mathematical kind of thinking at all. It's a very rich.
You know, and Piaget had this pegged at roughly 12 years of age, but research I've seen on interpersonal relationships that come up, for example, in the counseling therapy room, is that people move much more slowly in terms of interpersonal relationships, so that adolescents that could be 15, 16 years old or even older are often not working as operations yet. No, you see that. You see this incredible conformity that adolescents go through when their juices start running. Well, that's not formal operations. That's concrete operations dragging along.
Right. It was certainly the self-sense stuck at concrete operations. As mentioned previously, Piaget referred to the final stage, the intellectual growth of the young persons, as formal operations, indicating that he or she can now think in formal or abstract terms without needing to rely on ideas of concrete objects for examples. In fact, formal operations opens the door to advanced thinking of many kinds. Legal reasoning, for instance, relies on notions of equality, justice, and consistency over a wide range of actual situations, as does mature political reasoning. Indeed, the ability to reason in terms of broad generalizations is vital to all forms of science and scholarship, and to the arts as well. It is an essential tool of adult intelligence. And indeed it is, which is, again, sort of the sad part about individuals that are not able to acquire this for lack of education or lack of, you know, being able to afford education or background situation. But it's truly handicapping somebody if they're not developed to formal operational.
Well, as Bob Keegan titled his book, In Over Our Heads, even if we have that level, we're not really prepared for the modern world. But if we don't have that level, we really are pretty well stuck with understanding the world we live in.
And this is also, with the emergence of formal operational, that introspection becomes possible. And you point this out, for example, having acquired skills in formal operational thinking, the young person may, for the first time, be able to stand outside himself or herself as an objective observer. This act can trigger memorable experiences of awakening as a human being, sometimes eliciting palpable transcendent overtones. And you give a beautiful quote of that.
A couple of really nice quotes from literature on that.
Yeah. And so it's another way that, you know, I think that formal operational, like the term structuralism itself, has gotten kind of a bad rap. You know, it's supposed to be just, in this day and age of feelings and, you know, embodied this and embodied that, formal operational has gotten a very bad rap indeed. But even embodied feelings take formal operations, because you can't introspect without.
I remember Elizabeth Dybul telling me not long ago, you know, one of the major editors of Enlightened Next, she says, women are, there's such a push for women to be embodied, And, you know, in a way that's fine, but she said, and part of our problem is that we're too embodied.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
The whole landscape out there, the way people look at women. So that's a, yeah, that's a good point. I remember Rollo May back in the 60s, you know, getting some people got up, and he had given this wonderful talk, and somebody said, well, that's just bullshit. Let's get down to our emotions, you know. Somebody probably been out with Fritz Perls or something. And
right.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you don't like what I got to say, you can leave. You know, God gave me a brain and a good mind. I'm going to stand right here intending to use it. That was all back in the 60s, you know, because there was a big push then.
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Like Fritz Perls crawling out on the stage under Abraham Maslow, get down here with the rest of us, you know.
and Maslow saying, this begins to look like sickness.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Oh, little did he guess just how much sickness we were going to get.